as we'll soon see, there's such an anti-movement about these 2.5 Shvatim. Let's read the Psukim, and the truth is, one of the exciting things about this article, I don't know how much of it we'll finish, I hope we can finish the whole thing, is that how far can you push what I call Pshuto Shel Mikra? Because as we read the Psukim, we'll see clearly why there's such an anti-Ruven Gad v'chatzi Shev Menashe movement, because the Psukim seem to indicate that they're on the wrong track. So you'll see the Psukim in bold here at the, in the, on the right column.
Okay, so that's what Oswald has something very nice on this.
Does he try to defend them as well?
No. But he just says why these three specifically couldn't make it into Eretz Yisrael, or these 2.5.
Because I'll tell you the truth, if he, meaning Rav Pinchas Friedman here, doesn't quote the Bnei Yisoskar, it means that it's not going to be support for his position.
Because
he knows the Bnei Yisoskar inside out.
Right.
So look at the pasuk. I mean, simply, ein mikra yotze v'dei pshuto. You know, the simple understanding of the pasuk. It says umikne rav. I really should have brought an English translation. Okay, it doesn't matter. Umikne rav. So these are three shvatim that are very heavy with flock, right? A lot of animals. Lebnei ruven ulebnei gad. Okay, Menashe is not mentioned here. That comes in later. Otsum mi'od, so a massive amount of flock. So for flock you need what?
Land.
Grazing land, right? Grazing land. Vayir'u et eretz, vayir'u, they saw, they beheld, I guess you'd say, eretz ya'azor, the eretz gilad, these are all famous places on the other side of the Jordan River. I guess you try the eastern side of the Jordan River. I don't know if I'd be saying this right, Transjordan, whatever it is. This is a great place to raise our flocks. But yet we haven't crossed the Jordan yet. I mean, who's going to lead the battalion again to cross the Jordan?
Reuben?
No. I'm saying who's going to be the military commander-in-chief?
Yoshua.
So Yoshua hasn't yet even begun to cross the Jordan. And these guys, pardon the expression, are saying, we want to stay here. We want to be on this side. We don't even want to cross the Jordan. And Moshe Rabbeinu is going to react with a tremendous harsh thing that you just simply don't want to fight the battles and you're trying to get out of it. You're one of these, how do you call it in English? Ari Kim. Yeah, the draft dodgers. You're a draft dodger. You want a 4D, right? The draft dodge. Now, if we found grace in your eyes, yutanes eretz azos le'avdecha. Why can't we live here and we'll take over possession of this achuza, of this territory? Don't take us over the Jordan River. And he points out, again, I'm not going to read every word in the text, but just to summarize the next paragraph, he says that when you look at these psukim, it seems clear at the face of it that these guys were interested in making a buck. Mm-hmm. They weren't interested in Eretz Yisrael. After all, the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael, really begins on the other side of the Jordan. They want to stay on this side of the Jordan. And they're willing to give up their rights to receive a territory in Eretz Yisrael proper for the sake of their flocks. Because of this phrase, Mikre Rav, Mikne Rav. Mikne Rav means a massive amount of flocks. You may remember that the Jewish people back in Egypt settled where?
In Goshen.
But there was a little bit different because the Mitzrim, they didn't appreciate raising flocks and all that stuff. So that has sort of... But there also, Goshen was an area that was very fertile land. So here they want fertile land. Which is more important now? And this is the challenge that every Jew faces today. Mm-hmm. Especially Jews who come from Chutzlar. So, which is greater on your priority list? Is it Eretz Yisrael or is it making a buck? My son, for example, is a physician. He's in emergency medicine. And he found his own compromise. So what he does is, let's say 5 out of 7 weeks or so, 5 out of 6 weeks, he's in Ashdod, which is a branch of the Asuta Hospital of Tel Aviv. They opened up a branch in Ashdod. And he does emergency medicine. And then every 6 weeks or so, he picks himself up and he goes to either Syracuse or Poughkeepsie where he does emergency medicine, and he makes more money in a week than he makes in 6 weeks here. And if it's during Christmas or other holidays, then he makes 150%. Notice they give him almost double. But that's the decision. You know, surely a physician could do better in America, although even now it's getting very tricky for physicians in America because of the various insurance issues and so forth. But then there's Eretz Yisrael. So I was at a bris this morning. I don't know if any of you know Norman, Richard Norman. So he spoke.
Richard Norman? Yeah, sure.
So he spoke at the bris. He says he came here with his wife a year ago to be here for 5 weeks, and he still hasn't left, almost a year ago. This week he said it'll be a year. He says he just loves it here. And it completely changes his whole life. So here's a group of 2.5 shvatim that come to Moshe Rabbeinu and they say, on our priority list, it's more important to stay where we can make a good living, a good profit. So this generates what I call an anti-movement against these two shvatim. And he says, if you find a medrash here, which is towards the bottom of your right column, he says, Atamotzi b'bnei Gad u'bnei Ruven, if you check out their financial situation, hayu ashirim, they would be of the richest Jews of the Jewish community at that time. Hayu lehem mikne gadol. If you were a Syrian, you would say they were in the shmata business, what I'm saying? the Syrians make it big. I visited one Syrian Jew. He has a place in Manhattan. He has a building that takes up the whole block in Manhattan. Anyway, of course you have to see him during certain hours, and then you wait in the ante room and you see all the sportswear advertisements for everyone.
The reason why was that those Toshmatim, they ate man, they did not use their flocks where...
You have a kasha. Why do they care about the flocks? But they knew that the man would stop. In fact, it's very interesting. The man was Bischus Moshe Rabbeinu. And after Moshe Rabbeinu died, there was no more man.
Right. Wow.
So they knew that at that point, they couldn't eat man. They couldn't survive on man. So the Medrash says, Chivivu es mamonam. I mean, could you imagine such a statement?
Okay.
Now, you and I would understand that, living in the Western society, in the culture that we live in, okay, Chivivu es mamonam, that's not a terrible thing. People like to make money, right? But therefore, says the Medrash, Yashvu lehem chutz laretz. They decided to choose chutz laretz. Today if somebody said, well, I can make a better living in Chutzah, it's okay. So he's not up to the standards of Aliyah Feret, so fine. I wouldn't wouldn't put him in Cherem. But at this particular juncture in Jewish history, when the entire nation is at the verge of reaching the apex of this entire period of time that's hundreds of years old, from the time that we were Meshuvah and Mitzrayim until finally we're at the banks of the Jordan, and these guys say no, we want to be Ashirim, we want to be the wealthy guys. So there's a tremendous criticism here, critique against these 2.5 shvat. B'maimar Zeh, on the bottom right, he says, the purpose of this essay, of this presentation, is to enjoy a different view and a different perspective on this 2.5 shvat. And he says that in order to present my thesis, we have to read a Rashi at the end of Chumash. And he claims that if we read the Rashi carefully, we'll see a whole different approach to B'nai Gad U'B'nai Ruvein. So in order to do so, we should really again open up a Chumash, but because of we started a little bit late today, I'll just summarize the Pesukim. You'll see it in the middle section. Ulegad Amar, these are the blessings that Moshe Rabbeinu is bestowing on the various Shvatim. Baruch Marchiv Gad. Now this is really interesting because Moshe Rabbeinu is actually applauding God, the Shevet God, for its marchiv, for the spans of territory that it took over. And then there are a lot of different words here which we're going to skip for our purposes. And then it says at the end, it says Vayareshit lo. Do you see those words? You might want to underline those words. I'm going to underline them in my edition. I have the expanded edition. It's a little bit easier for me. So it says Vayareshit lo. Very strange kind of phrase. Reshit could mean many different things, but as we'll soon see in Rashi, the word Reshit here means at the very beginning of the process of settling the land of Israel. So where did, when we talk about the Shvatim settling the land of Israel, what's Reshit now going to be?
The first settlers?
That's going to be before we cross the Yarden. Are you with me on that? Is that clear? Okay.
Before. Not the first, before.
Maybe you're right and I'm wrong. Is it before or the first? I guess, no, you know what? Either way, I think it's just the same. What I mean to say is that if you imagine they haven't yet gotten to the Jordan River and they're already settling the land on the eastern side of the Jordan River, so that would be first or before. That's right. The Reshit. Okay. Now, Lo means for them. So if you put these three words together, Vayare Shit Lo means they saw that beginning land, right, the land before you entered Israel. Lo meaning they saw it for themselves, so to speak. Okay, now that could go either way. That's part of it. It could be negative, it could be positive. They saw this land and they said, this is for us. So Rashi says the following. Vayare Shit Lo Ra'ali Tolo, meaning God saw that it was fitting for them to take Chilek Be'eretz Sichon V'Og. Now let's understand. In our Parsha, Parsha's Matos, before they come forward to request that land, the Jewish people enter into a major military campaign against a very formidable adversary that's called Sichon V'Og.
Right.
And they actually are the nations that the seven nations. What do you say? Right, that
there's some board we once heard that in order before entering the land you have to conquer this the Sichon and Melchon and Cheshbon calculations because it doesn't make sense to be here.
Oh, you know, excellent.
At a certain level of a calculation point.
So again, they wanted to take over this land that was preoccupied by Sichon V'Og, Shehi Reshit Kibush Haaretz, which is at the very beginning or the first part of the conquering the land. Why? So if you put your finger on, you know, keep your finger on the place now, let's go back to the verse itself, which is five lines earlier. And it says, Kisham, there, and here's the Torah's answering the question why they wanted this area. Again, we'll see if it says anything about wealth and money and mikneh. Kisham chelkas mechokek sofer. Again, very complicated Hebrew, but let's try to do the best we can. I don't have an English translation here. So, to the best of my knowledge, it means there, sham, chelkat, there's a section. That's for the Mechokek. The Mechokek is the legislator. Obviously, there's a reference to a certain human being here, but not by name, so we have to figure out who that is. The word Safun means he's hidden. Now, the Chelka... Okay, great, great, great. Avram, you already got the punchline here, the whole story, but I'm not ready for that yet, because I just want to work out the etymology here, meaning how we interpret the Pasuk. The word Chelka... By sheer association, both in biblical Hebrew and in modern Hebrew, refers to a plot for burial. Like, for example, my parents are buried here on Har Menuchot. They have what's called a chelka. That's what it's called, even to this day. Now, safun means that's where you hide something. What are we hiding in a burial plot, so to speak?
The body.
The body, right? The body itself. So they saw, meaning God and then Reuven, we'll see exactly the relationship between God and Reuven, how they work in tandem. They saw in this territory, which was previously occupied by Sichon and Og, they saw a plot of a burial plot, Safun, and it was there was going to be a burial of someone in that plot who's called the Mechoke. So now if we'd only know what the word Mechokek refers to, we could try to figure out why they wanted to settle in that land where there's a burial plot. A lot of people today, for example, want to settle in Hebron. Who's buried in Hebron? Wow, that's a pretty impressive, high caliber people. Says Rashi, again, if you didn't lose the place, Kisham Chelkat, Ki Yada, because God was aware... Asher Sham, there binachlato in their territory, if they would inherit that territory, chelkatz deik vurat mechokek, there would be an area that was designated for the burial of the legislator with a capital L. Who's that? Vehu Moshe. Moshe is going to be buried there. Safun otach chelkas funa utmuna mikol biryah. You know, you could say about any burial plot that there's a dead body that's hidden, but in the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, it's really hidden. What do I mean? It's really, really hidden?
Forever. Nobody knows where.
What is your first name? I'm sorry. Yeah.
Moshe.
Why would you say about the burial plot of Moshe that it's really hidden? Because to this day, we don't know where it is. Nobody.
What does that mean, it's really hidden? Like,
in other words, nobody could say... If I would come to you and say, well, my name is Burzal, and I'm an archaeologist, right? And I can tell you exactly where Moshe Rabbeinu is buried. We know the general area where he's buried. The Torah goes into great detail at the end of Chumash Dvarim. And by the way, who buried Moshe? Does anybody know?
Hashem.
God himself buried Moshe. But the Pasuk, but the Pasuk testifies, Lo Yoda Ish Makom Kvurasa, which means we'll never... Arayom. Nobody can claim they know where Moshe is buried today, right? It's like no one can claim where the Aseres Hadibros were given. You know, there are a lot of people who say, oh, in Egypt.
Aaron and Miriam are buried?
I don't know. Anybody know the answer to that question?
Aaron for sure. Or people go. Rabbi Maxwell from Brooklyn went. It's in Jordan. You can go to
Aaron Cohen's
character.
I'm Michael. I don't want to go to Jordan. But I get scared about Jordan.
People have gone.
Yeah, no, I don't say no. I know that there was some. You know,
I think Miriam is in Eretz Yisrael somewhere.
Somewhere, maybe. I don't know. But Moshe, we know where the general location is, but we're not sure exactly where it is. So the word Safun in this context is very appropriate. Because Safun means it's hidden to the naked eye. We don't know. Again, every burial place is hidden to the naked eye, but this one in particular. And that's what he says, Shenemar, he quotes the Pasuk at the end of this Rashi, V'lo yada ish es kvuras. Nobody knows where Moshe Rabbeinu is buried. So my friends, we're about to see a whole different story appear in front of our eyes, based on this Rashi at the end of the Chumash. It's not the harsh criticism of the Mejmish that these are a bunch of wealthy guys who want to make a buck and they love their money and love their money to the extent they don't want to participate in one of the most glorious moments in Jewish history. No, here's a whole other story. And that's what this essay is all about. That this Shevet, again, at this point we're focused on God. In a minute we'll get to Reuven. But this Shevet wants desperately to be the territory in which Moshe Rabbeinu is buried. And that's what he points out in the next paragraph. You'll see on the fourth line, Hishtokuku. Hishtokuku means a tshuka, an intense craving to be close to Moshe Rabbeinu, their Rebbe, even after his death. But again, you might ask the question, that's only God. Where does Reuven fit into the picture? So you and I might say, well, maybe Reuven didn't have the right motivations. And only God had the right motivations. So in order to answer that question, he quotes a Medrash. But you know what? Before we get to that, for some reason, I'm not sure exactly why, he goes into a little bit of a digression and he quotes the Ramban. The Ramban has a problem which we're going to try to solve with an alternative, not the way the Ramban solves it. Again, for this we really need a chumash, but I'm going to try to do the best I can without a chumash. The pasuk says, and we started that at the very beginning of our discussion, "Umikne Rav Hayol Bnei Reuven uBnei Gad." So both Reuven are mentioned. Reuven and Gad are mentioned. Who comes first?
Reuven.
But then, if you fast forward, it says in the very next unit of Psukim, it says, Vayavo b'nei Gad u'b'nei Reuven vayomru el Moshe. So it's interesting that when the parasha opens up, it opens up by putting Reuven's name first, and then God second, and tells the whole story about the whatever this phrase, Mikne Rav, is, which we're going to have to try to interpret in just a minute. But then when it comes to the approaching of Moshe, you know, with their request, here God's name is mentioned first. So the Ramban is very, very challenged by this. You know, why the switch in the order? So the Ramban says the following: that in the initial pasuk, when you talk about Mikne Rav, he says Reuven gets first dibs. He's going to be mentioned first because he has the rights of Bechorah. You know, you talk about money. Who gets the of all the children? And in this case, of all the Shvatim, which Shevet should get the best rights to inherit the property of the parent?
The Bechor,
correct? So Reuven has first rights, because he's the Bechor, he's the firstborn. So he's got to be mentioned first. But, says the Ramban, in terms of the motivation, who was the prime mover, which Shevet was the prime mover here between Reuven and Gad to claim that area for their own, he says Gad. And that's why throughout the entire parasha, and that phrase, B'nai Gad or B'nai Reuven, appears multiple times, it's always Gad first. Why? Because Heim Hayu HaMedabrim HaTchila LeMoshe. They are the ones who took the initiative and came forward to Moshe Rabbeinu. They were the strong members of the community, which we'll see again at the end of the Chumash when Moshe bestows a blessing on them. It says, "Vitaraf Zroa Afkod Kod," from the descendants of God, we're going to get the fiercest, you know, most powerful soldiers that are going to fight, you know, tooth and nail and rip apart our enemies. And therefore, lefichach lo hayireim l'sheves levadom b'eretz hazos. So the Rabban has a whole thesis here. Why was it that, although Reuven apparently was also in cahoots here with God, but they didn't have the same gumption and the same motivation that God has? Why would God more motivated? So it turns out like this. The Rabban comes up with a major creative thesis. He says that militarily, if you take the area on the eastern side of the Jordan, you're more vulnerable, you're more exposed to the adversaries. Why? Because you're not linked up with the rest of the Shvatim. So let's say, for example, an enemy attacks you, you're stuck now alone. Reuven was a little bit inhibited about that. But God had no problem because they were the fierce warriors and they weren't afraid of settling alone. Geographically alienated from the cut off from the rest of the nation. That's the Ramban's opinion. However, we're going to take another approach. We're going to try to justify why God always appears first, not because of their reliance and confidence on their military might, but because they were the ones, as we see from the blessing of Moshe at the end of Moshe's life, they were the ones who were really motivated because they wanted to be close to Moshe Rabbeinu. So it's really interesting. In terms of the two approaches as to where we place God in this whole picture and the motivation of God, one approach is that they were interested in making money, even at the expense of not participating in the conquering of Eretz Yisrael. The other approach is because they wanted to be close to Moshe Rabbeinu. Then, from the first perspective, if you're looking at this parasha on a physical level, so the Rabban offers the fact that the God was motivated. Again, both God and Reuven were equally heavy with flock. But Reuven was a little bit scared to take that area and be alone in case the adversaries would pounce upon them. God had no fears. He was the fearless God. But if we take the second approach and we ask why God's name is mentioned with one exception, but it's mentioned consistently first, that's because God was the one who really, really desired to be close to the Makom Kvura, to the burial place of Moshe. Okay. Now, having said this, what's Pshatu Mikne Rav? In other words, in the first approach, that's classical, that all they were interested in is money, that's what motivated. So then I understand Mikne Rav. Mikne Rav means they were laden with massive amounts of sheep and so forth and so on. However, if we take the second approach, right, that they were motivated because they wanted to be close to Moshe Rabbeinu, it was a spiritual motivation. So what's Mikne Rav? You know, with all due respect, we can't just erase two words of the Torah. So he quotes the Sfasemes. The Sfasemes was the giant of Ger, the Ger Hasidim. And he says, you know what Mikne Rav means? Mikne Rav means a kinyan atzum im harav shehu Moshe Rabbeinu. The possession here is not the possession of property, of physical material wealth, but rather possession of Rav, Mikne Rav. So the word Mikne doesn't mean flock. Mikne comes from the shoresh of what?
Kinyan.
Kinyan, which means possession, ownership. And Rav doesn't mean a massive amount, but rather Rav means their Rebbe. They had a tremendous Kinyan. Kinyan means a closeness. You know, in order to make a Kinyan, I always have to lift up the object, right? If it's a movable object, right? So they had a Kinyan in Moshe Rabbeinu. And that meant their dveikus, their connection, their loyalty. They were always, always connected to Moshe Rabbeinu. Of all the Shvatim, God was the most outstanding Shevet with this close relationship to Moshe Rabbeinu. And then they knew that Moshe Rabbeinu, according to the decree of heaven, was not going to enter into the land of Israel, but rather he'll be buried where? Be'evra Yarden, on the eastern side of the Jordan. Lachen, therefore, Bikshu Lekabel Shom Nachal Kedei Shalom Lipared Mimenu. They didn't want to separate themselves from Moshe. I'll give you an example. Again, I'm getting a little bit personal here, but I remember when my mother passed away, after the Shiva was over, we were thinking, you know, what do we do with all our possessions? It's a heart-wrenching experience. I hope you'll never have to go through it. But what happens after parents go? It was an issue what to do with my father's suits, for example. So I wanted to be close to my father. I wanted to wear my father's suits. You know, the other people say that's spooky. I don't want to wear the dead person's suits, you know. But I felt it would have an influence on me, and I'd be close to my father. And I remember after my mother passed away, we were looking at our collection of eyeglasses. She wore different kinds of glasses, you know, sunglasses and reading glasses and this glasses and that glass. And people, I don't know if any of you know any people, but some people accumulate stuff. They don't know how to throw things out. So my mother's glasses collection went back 50 years. And I'll never forget, Shiva was over, and I was touching her eyeglasses, and I just fell apart. I felt like I was touching her. I don't know. It was like a closeness, you know. See, you might ask the question, you know, Menashe, I'm sorry, we'll get to Menashe later, but God is totally dedicated to the relationship to that Rebbe, to Moshe Rabbeinu. They don't want to separate from him. But what good is it to be next to his kvura, next to his burial? You know, that's posthumous. That's not going to... But nevertheless, you want to be close to someone even after they die.
We're talking just God and Reuven right now, not Menashe.
Okay. No, now we're talking about God. We're going to get to Reuven in just a second. You know, so again, according to our thesis, and we saw this also in the Sfas Emes and Rashi in Parshas Vezos Habracha, the real motivator was Reuven. Well, excuse me, I'm sorry. The real motivator was God. The word motivated or motivator was
motivation,
God.
I guess, was Moshe. But it says in the Pasuk, it says, Umikne Rab Hayav Ne Reuven. So I thought Reuven maybe is going to want to be closer to Moshe Rabbeinu.
So take a look. Take a look in the next paragraph, because this is where he tries to get Reuven into the picture. He says the following. What we find explicitly in the Torah, in the bracha of Moshe Rabbeinu, in the Vezosa bracha. By the way, this essay could be both for Parshas Matos and equally for Parshas Vezosa bracha. He has it here for Parshas Matos. That's how I got to it. But it really, to some extent, it belongs there. Because in the blessing that Moshe Rabbeinu bestows upon God, it's clear that it's Vayar Reishis Lo Kisham Chelkas Mechokik Sof, when Rashi says that this is God who wanted to be close to Moshe Rabbeinu. So therefore the question arises, where do we fit Reuven into this whole picture? So he quotes one of the greats. His name was Saba, was his last name. He was the Tzror HaMor. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It's a great commentary on Chumash, but very Kabbalistic. He was Spanish Jews that was expelled from Spain 5 years ago. We call him Megurashe Sfarad. And then I think he settled in Syria. They called it. They didn't call it Syria in those days. They called it Aram Tzova.
Yeah.
So anyway, so this article, to some extent, is built on this insight of the Tzror HaMor. But in any event, basically, Reuven is motivated also, like God, to settle in that land where Moshe Rabbeinu is going to be buried. The only problem is that Reuven is a little bit east of God. So how do we understand this? If you turn to the second page, he says the following, that second. Again, I'm trying to see what we can fit into the amount of time that we have. Oh, take a look at a Gemara in Sota, which he quotes on the bottom right. Do you have it? You know, whenever you see the bold print, you know he's quoting Chazal. And Rabbi Yehuda says in the Gemara in Sota that where did Moshe die? He died in the territory of Reuven. Now this is a little bit strange, because if he died in the territory of Reuven, why was he buried in the territory of Gad? How does Rabbi Yehuda know that Moshe died in the territory of Reuven? Because the pasuk says, "Vayal Moshe me'arvot Moav al Har Nevo." We know that Moshe passed on the top of a mountain called Har Nevo. And Rabbi Yehuda says that Nevo on the map, I don't have a map for you, I should have prepared one, but on the map, Nevo is in the chelik, the territory of Reuven. And that's based on a pasuk that says, "Ubnei," in this week's parasha, "Ubnei Reuven beno Chanoch," etc. It says, "Ves Nevo." Nevo was the territory of Reuven. But yet, paradoxically, Heichan Moshe Kavur, where is Moshe buried? Bechelko Shel Gad. So how do we reconcile this contradiction, says Rabbi Yehuda? On the one hand, the Torah indicates that Reuven, that where did Moshe die? In Nevo, which is in the territory of Reuven. On the other hand, we know that Moshe was buried in the territory of Gad. How do we reconcile this? So Rabbi Yehuda says the following. Michelko shel Reuven at Chelko shel Gad, he says that if you're on the, let's say, the most western point of the territory of Reuven and the most eastern point of the territory of Gad, then you're separated by Arba Milin. Okay, Arba Milin is something that would take you about an hour to walk that distance. It's a very short hour relatively. The Osan Arba Milin Miholicho, who took the coffin of Moshe Rabbeinu and brought it, those 4 milin, from Nevo, which is chelik of Reuven, all the way to the chelik of Gad, says Rabbi Yehuda, Malamet Shaya Moshe Mutal Bekanfei Shechina, that Moshe's body was resting on the wings, if you take it literally, the wings of the Shechina of God. Malachi Ashores Omrim, and they recited Tzadakta Hashem Asa U'mishpatav Im Yisrael. So basically what's happening is that God is carrying on his wings, again in inverted commas, right? He's carrying the body of Moshe. So it turns out that if I were to ask you about the death of Moshe and his burial, is it connected to Reuven or to God? The answer is very complicated. Because on the one hand, Hashem saw to it that Moshe would die in the chelik of Reuven, and that's a reward for Reuven's desire to be close to Moshe. But on the other hand, there's an area that we have to traverse of 4 milin to get to the burial place of Moshe, which is going to be where? In the chelik of God. And why in the chelik of God? Because as we saw over and over again, God is the one who takes the first initiative. He's the more motivated than Reuven. Again, not with the Ramban's approach, that the Ramban says he was more motivated because he wasn't afraid of the adversaries, he's such a tough guy, but rather because he was really completely dedicated, God, the Shevet of God, to Moshe Rabbeinu. They wanted to be in the place of the Chelek, of the Kvura Chelek of Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay. Now, what is the significance of the burial place of Moshe Rabbeinu? Now, within the chelik of God, which area is the area in which Moshe Rabbeinu is buried? Does anybody know what that's called?
In the Torah?
Yeah, in other words, if you took apart the chelik of God into its various segments, its districts, there was one district which was designated by the Almighty for the burial of Moshe within God. That's called Beit Pa'ar. And we'll see the psukim in just a second, but what does that word pa'ar by share association remind you of?
Baal
pa'ar is an idol, correct?
Right.
And that idolatry was in Jewish
pe'ayin
vav resh, right? And that idol worship, which unfortunately, tragically, the Jewish people were guilty of at one point in history, was connected with what episode?
Didn't we just have
Do you remember? Yeah. Who are the people? I'm saying it in a way that I don't give away the answer. Who are the people that enticed the Jewish people to
Midianites?
Correct, the Midianite women.
Right.
Because they made a deal. You know, they said, look, you do this avoda, this idol worship. That's what they said to the Jewish men. You do the idol worship with Pa'ar, and then we'll do what we're going to do together, right? So why was Moshe Rabbeinu, of all places, he's buried in Beit Pa'ar? So this is the next part of the same Gemara that we started in Sotah. It's on the top left if you want to see the text inside.
Beit Pa'or is where they did the Averas?
Yeah. And that's where Moshe Rabbeinu is buried. Does anybody know what the worship was to Pa'or? This is the Gemara in Sanhedrin.
Defecation,
exactly. It's like the lowest of the low. And that's the area that Moshe Rabbeinu is buried in. So the Gemara asks...
Israel, we assume?
Yeah, this is on the eastern side of the Jordan in the territory of Gad. But within the larger territory of God, we're pinpointing an area which is called Beit Pa'ar. And that's where the Torah identifies the place of burial, of Moshe. If you... Again, I never know, especially since, you know, you're not always around for my Chumash classes, do you want to see the text inside or you don't? I don't know.
I'm pretty not so bothered.
I always want to cover my bases. So just in case you're interested in the text, on the second page, which hopefully I have open to you, if you take a look in the bottom of the middle category, middle column, you'll see a pasuk in Vizos HaBracha, which is four lines up before the end. I'm underlining it because I'm heavy into the text here. Vayamat, the Torah testifies, Vayamot Sham Moshe, Eved Hashem, Be'eretz Moav. So Moshe dies in a place called Nevo in Eretz Moav. Al Pi Hashem. Okay, God somehow kisses him and he dies. Vayikbar Oto, but again, afterwards he was moved by, as we saw earlier in the Gemara, that he was taken by the Kanfei Ashkina for 4 million into the area of Gad. But where in Gad?
Vayikbar.
What do you say?
Did the Bnei Israel see this? Moshe passing? Never really thought about that.
I don't think so. I think he went up privately up to the top of Nevo.
Okay.
But this is the next. Vayikbar Oto Begai. He was buried in a place called Gai, the Eretz Moav. And Eretz Moav, by the way, is a massive area of that spills over to both Gad and Reuven. Mul Beit Pa'ar. So it's called Gai, and it's directly opposite Beit Pa'ar. Now again, Moshe is not buried in Beit Pa'ar. So if I said that before, I stay corrected. He's buried Mul Beit Pa'ar. You know, to bury Moshe Rabbeinu in Beit Pa'ar, I mean, that has bad associations, if you know what I mean. And Rashi again says, who buried Moshe in Beit Pa'ar? Mul Beit Pa'ar. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. So the Gemara asks on the top left, Nikbar Moshe Eitzel Beit Pa'or. And the Gemara's answer is Kidei Lechaper Al Maase Pa'or. Somehow Moshe Rabbeinu's burial place is going to atone for the sin that took place in Pa'or. And Tosus quotes a Medrash to embellish this. Bechol Shana V'Shana, on an annual basis. He doesn't tell you exactly what month in the calendar. So let's say, what month are we up to today? We're in Tammuz, right? Let's say, for argument's sake, again, this is 1 out of 12 that I'm getting this right. Let's say in the month of Tammuz, on an annual basis, Be'et Shechatu Yisrael B'Bnos Moav, at the time in which, in the calendar, going back thousands of years, the Jews sinned with the daughters of Moav, Be'oto Perek, at that time, annually, Beit Pa'or Ola Lamaila, an image of this area goes up to Shamayim, to the heavenly court. Which court, my friends? The good court, you know, the defendants, or the prosecution? It's the prosecution. Kidei Lekatreg Ulahazkir Ovon. You know, we think that Cheta Egel, which was one of the catastrophic primary sins, that haunts us throughout Jewish history. That's true. But we don't know until we see this Tosus in the Sefer Sota is that there's another sin of Klal Yisrael that haunts us throughout history, and that's the sin of Pa'ar, because at that place called Pa'ar, not only did we sin with the non-Jewish women of Moab, the Bnos Moab, but we also sinned by worshipping Baal Pa'ar, by idolatry. So this is, you know, to some extent, I would tell you this is even a worse sin than the eagle. You know, in the case of the eagle, we have all sorts of attempts to justify. But here, this is like, and what kind of an idol worship is, to defecate in front of an idol. I mean, that's like the lowest of the low. The Chol Sha'ah Sha'ole, on the annual basis, when this terrible thing happens in the heavens, you know, and there's an image of our the ancestry sin, so to speak, is then Chozer V'Nishka L'Mokom She'Shako Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu took this pa'ar and he buried it and he destroyed it. And every year, Moshe Rabbeinu's, you know, presence in that particular area, which is in, posthumously, but he's in Mul Beit Pa'ar, that's going to create a kapara, an atonement for the sin of Pa'ar. And if that be the case in the next paragraph, based on the Gemara and Sota, we can begin to appreciate why B'nai God want to be so close to the burial place of Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's because they wanted to be part of this entire process in which Moshe Rabbeinu on an annual basis, posthumously, is generating a kapara, an atonement for Klal Yisrael. It's almost as if Moshe Rabbeinu is like still alive. I don't want to say that because you'll get the wrong impression. What I mean to say is that even in his death, Moshe Rabbeinu is still praying on behalf of the Jewish people in order to destroy what he calls, Rabbi Friedman calls it, the klipas bal pa'ar, that negative influence of Pa'ar that still somehow exists in the spiritual universe that comes up annually on that point, on that moment, in front of the Kisei HaKovod L'Katrig al Klal Yisrael to condemn Klal Yisrael. And this is the punchline. He says the following. Imagine if all the Shvatim would have crossed the Jordan, which was in one sense the ideal original plan. No one's left now on Eivor HaYarden, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So he claims, the Shvilei Pinchas, that if there would be no Jewish population on that side of the Yarden, then God would not have buried Moshe there. Because he can't bury Moshe amongst the non-Jews. Again, you might have a kasha from Esther and Mordechai, I think they say they're buried in Shushan. Yeah. Is that so? But as a general rule,
Hamadan. Today it's called Hamadan.
Hamadan. Okay, Hamadan. There are still people who visit there. What? It's in Iraq or Iran?
Iran.
Sorry. Yeah, Iran. Yeah, I wouldn't want to go there today. But let's say people go there. But in the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, as important as it was for Moshe Rabbeinu to be buried Mul Beis Pa'ar, but since it would be on this side of the Jordan, Hashem would have to give up on that plan because he would not leave Moshe Rabbeinu in a place that's not surrounded by Jews, that's completely surrounded by non-Jews. Therefore, when they came forward, that's Gad and Reuven, to ask to be settled, to settle that land, basically, they wanted to facilitate Moshe's ability to be, again, I'll read to you his language, l'achnia b'kedushato et klipat bal par. This is a mystical concept. So therefore, when Moshe Rabbeinu dies, where did he die? In which chelek?
Reuven.
Chelek of Reuven. But he's buried in the chelek of Gad. And he says that to understand this, we have to take a look at the Chidah, right? Azulai, who lived about 2.5 centuries ago, who quotes an earlier commentary, who quotes Rishonim, so we're going back really in time. On the Pasuk, in Breishit, Perek Lamed, it says, Vatomer Lea Bagad. What does that mean, Vatomer Lea Bagad? And he says that this is a remez to someone who was born on Bagad. What does that mean, born on Bagad? So if you take the Bet and the Gimel, and that's 2 and 3 is 5, and then you add the Dalet, which is 4. Just 1 second, how did I mess up here? 3 and 4. My mistake. Shenola Bit, on the day of Gad. Right now, Gad is a shevet, and Leah calls at birth calls this baby Bagad, and therefore she declares Bagad. Now his name is not Bagad; his name is Gad. So what does Bagad mean? So comes along the Chidah with a sensational chiddush. Bagad means be-gad, meaning in the territory of God. Now what's God? God is 3 plus 4 is 7. And 7 here is an allusion to the 7th of Adar. What happened on the 7th of Adar?
Moshe was born and died.
And he died. So we're going to focus on his death. Moshe dies on the 7th of Adar. And he's buried on the 7th of Adar. And where is he buried? In God. So Leah somehow, by calling this Shevet God, is already connecting this Shevet with the place where Moshe Rabbeinu is going to be buried on the 7th of Adar, and that's in the Chelek of God. And the Chidah asks the following question. Again, he's quoting one of the Rishonim. You know, he's going back 7 centuries earlier. Mipnei ma zocha God? Why was God the one who merited this? You know, so you and I would have said, well, because he was so motivated to request that area. But the Chidah has a different perspective here. And he says the following, that when Moshe Rabbeinu gave out the Dgolim, you remember that the 12 Shvatim were divided up into 4 camps, and each camp had 1 Shevet, of the 3 that was given the Degel Barash. In other words, the 4 Shvatim, when they traveled together through the wilderness, they were in a certain formation, and there was 1 Degel of those 3 Shvatim that would be given the, what word can I use in English, but the special prize, the special precious status of being the Rosh HaDegol.
For those three tribes.
Now, in those 3 tribes, we have Dan. Now, Dan is a descendant of Zilpah. Mm-hmm. Okay? Gad is a descendant of Bilhah. They were both firstborn. And yet, for some unknown reason, Dan is given the honor of being the Rosh HaDegel. And at this point, God could have come forward to Moshe and he could have complained. And he said, wait a minute, I'm a Bechor, I may have gotten the names mixed up, I'm a Bechor to Zilpah, Dan is a Bechor to Bilhah. I think I got the names mixed up.
Yeah, that's right, Dan is a Bechor to Bilhah.
No, I don't remember what I said before, but it doesn't matter. He says, Lama Eini, is this what God said? This is what God could have said, but right. Didn't say.
Were they sisters, Bilhah and Zilpah? Were they sisters or no?
I don't remember.
Right, okay.
So he says, Lama Eini Rosh Degel Kamo. Why don't I get to be the Rosh Degel? Right? But they didn't say that. They accepted Moshe's decision with silence, with acquiescence, with acceptance. And therefore, Omer lo Moshe, Moshe says to them, Havi zonav l'arayos v'altihi Rosh l'shu'olim. In other words, be humble, so to speak, and take a back seat whenever necessary. And that's why it says about the head of Shevet Gad, it says in Bamidbar at the very beginning, Eliasaf ben De'u'el. Please underline that word, De'u'el. Okay? If you fast forward to the 2nd chapter of Bamidbar, the same individual from Shevet Gad is called Eliasaf ben Re'u'el. And it's not a printing mistake. And says the Chidah, Ratzalomar, what does it mean here? Ale uzche lerea el, meaning between the first mention of the name and the second mention of the name, something great happens in for the Nasi, the head of Shevet Gad, whose name is Eliasaf. His father's name was Deuel, but the Torah then elevates him to Reuel. Reuel means a friend of God. Why and how does Eliasaf merit getting this upgrade? You know, instead of sitting in coach, he gets to sit in first class. Okay. And he's called Reuel. The answer is because between the first and the second, Moshe Rabbeinu divvies out the Degel and he gives it to the Rosh Shevet Dan instead of Shevet Gad, and God says nothing. So who's the representative of God? Who's the head honcho of God? His name is Eliasaf. Now we're going to change his name, meaning his father's name, and it's going to be Ben Reuel. because now you're considered a friend of God. And the Chidah develops this idea, where did God gain this attribute, this tremendous attribute, that he was able to accept the decision of Moshe, even though he had a valid claim? Korach, if you remember, did not accept the decision of Moshe when he thought he had a valid claim. And now, the Torah elevates God to Reuel, to the status of a Reuel. Reuel means Re'al Lakel, he's a friend of God. Why and how? And the answer is that the greatest attribute that a person could achieve in morality is anava, is humility. Moshe Rabbeinu is called the Anav Mikol Adam. He's the most humble of any human being on the map. And who is his close disciple who's always connected to Moshe? Yeshua. Well, besides Yeshua, God. Because God, as we said before, and God represents, he personifies Anava. He's really a duplicate of Moshe Rabbeinu. So if you take a look in a paragraph, again, only if you want to see it inside, that starts with the word Nimtzenu, and you skip to the third line in that paragraph. He says, Machmat hayoto davuk b'Moshe, because God is so connected to Moshe, and Moshe is the Anav Mikol Adam, the greatest personification of humility. And Moshe therefore says to God, you know what, take a back seat over here. For whatever reason, the divine being has decided to give the Degel to Dan. And because God is so close to Moshe, and he imitates Moshe, and he's therefore adopted this attribute of humility, therefore he doesn't say a word. He doesn't come forward and be Doresh is covered and say, wait a minute, how can you slight me in this way when I'm the Bechar? And therefore it makes sense, number one, that God is the motivator here to be buried, I'm sorry, to acquire ownership on that territory in which Moshe Rabbeinu is buried, because he wants to be close to Moshe Rabbeinu, because he, God, is very similar to Moshe Rabbeinu on a moral, ethical level. Because just like Moshe Rabbeinu is the Ish Anav Ma'od, he's the absolute personification of humility, so too God, who is Dovek Bo, he was very connected to Moshe Rabbeinu, he learned from Moshe Rabbeinu, and he's going to take a back seat instead of complaining when he could have complained. Now the question is, where do we fit Reuven into this picture? And we said that where did Moshe Rabbeinu die?
In Reuven.
And who came forward first, in the parasha? It was Reuven. Afterwards, God takes the center stage. But right now it's Reuven. Why Reuven? So if you take a look on the bottom right, line 4, which is 3 lines up before the end, in the paragraph that starts Ahina, he says, Shekamo God, just like God, I added a little paragraph in there, a little comma, I don't know if it came out on your photocopy. Kemo God, just like God, Machal Gam Reuven al Kvodo. Reuven was also willing to waive his honor and his esteem. Because what happens? Yaakov Avinu takes away, robs, so to speak, Reuven of the status of Bechor, and he gives it over to Yosef. So Yosef, if you remember, gets two portions. He gets that for Menashe and that for Ephraim. And Reuven holds no grudge about it. No grudge. In fact, Reuven is going to be the prime mover to save whom?
Yosef.
Ayishma Reuven v'yatzileo miyadam. It proves that he was harboring no anger or resentment against Yosef, even though Yosef was the one who would usurp Reuven's bechora. And the answer is because Reuven represents humility. Just like we saw God is a personification of humility, so too is Reuven. And the pasuk says, Vatar Leah Vatelid Ben Vatikrishmo Reuven. Says Rashi, why was Reuven called Reuven? What's the meaning of the name? What's in the name? Rabbi Senu Pirshu, Amra Ru'u Ma Beni Levain Chami. What's between me, my children, meaning Reuven, and Chami, that's Esav. And she says, Esav machar es habechor li Yaakov, and then he goes out on a manhunt to try to kill Yaakov. But Reuven lo machar li Yosef, he never sold it willingly to Yosef, nevertheless lo irol, if he has no complaint, he doesn't register any opposition, because he represents and embodies the midah of Anova. Now, which of the Shvatim that we're talking about have we not mentioned at all here? We mentioned Reuven, we mentioned Gad. What about Menashe? Where does he fit into this whole thing? So who is the Bechor of Yosef? Between Menashe and Ephraim. Menashe. But who is taken first by Yaakov? Ephraim. And we don't find anywhere that Menashe complained about this.
He was also a little boy at the time, no?
I don't know. Yosef Rembrandt has a famous Rembrandt painting, yeah. has a 9-year-old. I think he was a little bit older. Right. In any event, this is another case of a personification of Anova. It's unbelievable how history is repeating itself. You know, God could have claimed, I'm the Bechor, I should have the Degel Rishon.
Reuven
could have, he was the Bechor, he should have gotten the Bechor with two of his sons, should have gotten. And now we get to Menashe, he was the Bechor, and nevertheless, Yaakov Avinu chooses to put his right hand over Ephraim, and we don't find anywhere that Menashe complained about that. And this is Menashe's lot, and he accepts it. And he says the following. This is on the left column. Now, I see we have to finish it up, but I'm just trying to see what I could finish in the next 5 minutes. Okay, let me just say this. Menashe represents a very unique shevet, especially in terms of the dedication to Torah. No, that's my fault here. Sorry. I can't seem to successfully.
Can you click the side of the screen that might work? Like the volume button.
Okay, I'm just gonna try screen. Okay. If I can get you back for 5 minutes of your attention. So, why was Menashe split up? And the answer is because Menashe has such a powerful impact that he could influence the people of Israel, and Moshe Rabbeinu had a problem because now that he was giving over two Shvatim to territory on the eastern side of the Jordan, but the bulk of Klal Yisrael on the west, so he needed to give some chizuk, some strength to these two Shvatim. He couldn't let them alone, so he splits up Menashe. Again, it's a long discussion. But what I wanted to add, because I find this very profound, is on page 4. And there's an unbelievable connection here, says Rav Friedman, between Moshe Rabbeinu and the sin of Pa'ar, and how Moshe Rabbeinu is able to atone for the sin of Pa'ar. And he says the following, and again I'm summarizing a longer discussion, but just to get the punchline of it, the highlight of it. He says that Pa'ar, which is the lowest of the lowest avoda, is part of a philosophy. And what is that philosophy? The philosophy is that God looks the other way. What does that mean, God looks the other way? Again, what I'm about to say is pure idolatry, so don't take me seriously. But what was the idol worship of Pa'ar? Basically, what they were claiming is, if we can do this lowly act of defecation, and the El, the God, meaning Pa'ar, doesn't care, then we could do anything and God doesn't care. And this was the philosophy of the Benos Moav. How did they entice the Jewish people? They said, you know what? We want to show you something. We're going to show you a God, and we're going to show you how we worship this God, the motive of worship, and you're going to learn that God looks the other way. And all this, by the way, is based on a pasuk in Eov, because one of the psukim in Eov says that the worst crime is when we think that God couldn't care less. Their philosophy, the Baal Pa'ar, was that God couldn't care less. This is what we call false humility. God is so humble that he couldn't care less about what we do. Our actions are meaningless. This was a way that they could permit the lowest immorality. Because of this philosophy that God, what does he care? You're a human being. You're a low, you're a mortal person. You're not even a flea on the back of an elephant. Who are you? What does God give a hoot? Whether you do this, you do that. And that was the whole philosophy of the idol worship. And it was very enticing. And Klal Yisrael got caught up in this. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to teach us what is true, genuine humility. God is humility, but God has a certain will, and we cannot violate God's will. I could be the most humble person, but there's a will and there's a law, and we are meant to comply with that law. That's our greatest challenge in life. So we have here, and again, I'm just summarizing a long discussion, we have two forms of humility. One is false humility, and one is real, genuine humility. Any attribute, by the way, could be presented with a facade, and I could, you know, not I, but, you know, I could convince you that this is really, truly moral. The case of Anova is to create a God that's predicated on a false kind of anova, because that false kind of anova of humility leads you to the conclusion that God couldn't care less. There's no will of God. There's no rules and moral statutes that I have to comply with. I can violate everything, all for the sake of pleasure. And God couldn't care less. And this is one of the most powerful forms of idol worship. You know, we laugh at Par. I have to admit myself, I always laughed at Par. Come on. This is the way you respect your idol. You know, you want to bow in front of an idol. Okay. If he's your God, that's your God. I understand. But to defecate in front of it? I mean, it's the most disgusting thing you can imagine. But the answer is, that is the depths of this philosophy. It's kedei lahatir es hakol. The Baal Par of us means let it all loose. Why? Because God couldn't care less. He's not insulted. He's like not like a human being. You imagine you defecated in the presence of a king. You'd be beheaded immediately, right? But God looks the other way. I'll prove it to you. Here's Par, right? I'm looking at Par, and this is what I'm doing. If he looks the other way on that humility means that you can do everything. Carte blanche. You know, the world is open in front of you. Enjoy the world, because God couldn't care less. You have no way of impacting on God. You can't get God upset. He's above human kind of anger. And Moshe Rabbeinu represents the antithesis of the Baal Pa'ar philosophy. His philosophy is that humility and the compliance and the allegiance to God's will are reconcilable. They coexist. And therefore, the area in which God chooses to bury Moshe Rabbeinu is going to be Mul Beis Pa'ar, so that Moshe Rabbeinu, year in and year out, is going to atone for the sin of Pa'ar, because he represents the genuine Anova. Meaning, we are humble, and God is a personification of humility, but nevertheless, God has His will, He gave us His mitzvahs, and we have to comply with those mitzvahs, otherwise we're undermining God's sovereign rule. And this is what motivated both Reuven and Gad, and especially Gad, to be close to the burial place of Moshe. That's because of their connection to Moshe Rabbeinu, their humility. We said that both Gad and Reuven and Menashe, all three represent that humility, but not false humility, not the facade of Baal Pa'ar, but rather the genuine humility. And that genuine humility means lachnia, to subjugate oneself and accept the rule, the sovereign rule of God. That's what they want. And they were afraid that if they didn't offer and volunteer to settle and acquire that territory, Moshe Rabbeinu in the divine plan would not be able to be buried in that area. So if you want to just look at the last paragraph, and we'll close it here, and I apologize, we went a little over time. I'll try to rectify that next time, if you're around on Tuesday at 11. And he says the following. This is why in the divine plan, God wanted to give as a gift this Avra Yaradain area as a place designated for the burial of Moshe Rabbeinu, right there, Mul Beis Pa'ar. And it's got to be in the territory of B'nai Gad, B'nai Ra, Reuven, and Chatzi Shev Menashe. The common denominator of all three of them, they were all dveikus, they were all completely committed, clinging, and loyal to Moshe Rabbeinu, because they learned from Moshe Rabbeinu, they adopted the mid of Anova. But again, which anova, which humility? Not the humility of what he calls klipa, which is the negative humility, the pollution and the corruption of pa'ar, but rather the positive humility, which is called the anova of kedusha, that they would always waive their covet, even though each one of them individually had rights as a bechor, and they completely gave that up. And therefore, it's appropriate that Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the epitome, the personification of humility, is the Adam Mikol Adam, he should be buried in the chelek, in the part, Mul Beis Pa'ar, in order to help Klal Yisrael to understand and emulate what is true, genuine, anova. That's going to bring the kapara for Klal Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu will be buried mul beis pa'ar. And Emir Sashemi says we will ultimately be able to emulate Moshe Rabbeinu to the point in which we'll be able to undermine and neutralize any sort of Balpar philosophy. Our dedication and loyalty will be to the true, genuine humility. Ad shetisbata legamri v'bias Mashiach tzidkeinu v'mehera v'yomenu. Amen. Thank you so much. Any questions before we go? I just think...
Would you just listen to the Can you translate the
title of the lecture?
Yes.
Okay, let's go back to the title. Where did I put the page here? Okay. Ha-kesher. Ha-nifla. Okay, kesher means the connection. Ha-nifla means amazing. What country are you from?
South Africa.
So amazing? Amazing? How do you pronounce that word?
Amazing.
Oh, okay. Because I was once in South Africa and this woman said to me, amazing, something like that. I was amazed by it. The amazing connection between the three, Mishulash means the threefold chut. Chut is a rope, a string, what?
Thread.
A thread, excellent, thread. That's it, you got it. Avraham is my man, thread. I'm forgetting my English yet. The threefold thread of God, Reuven, and Menashe. So what is the amazing connection? Well, we would call it, in arithmetic, we'd say the lowest common denominator that connects both God, Reuven, and Menashe, and justifies Shezachu that they merited to receive a territory, a Nachlo is a territory, be Aver. The Aver means the other side of the Yarden, of the Jordan River, meaning the eastern side in this case, which is has a special unique holiness to it. It's the Makom Kvuroso Shel Moshe. It's the place, Makom, where Moshe Rabbeinu is buried.
And the eastern side is...
That's called...
Where there were less... That was the, where there were fewer...
Right, there were only... That represented perhaps 20% of the Jewish population. 80% went into Israel proper. So if you're ever in Jordan, which I wouldn't encourage you to go to because, I don't know, I don't trust the Jordanians right now. Again, if you get stuck with a flight and you're in the airport there in Amman for 2 hours to switch flights, that's okay. But to run around Jordan at this point, I'm a little bit concerned. You may remember that an Israeli security person in the embassy, killed two Jordanians.
Two
Jordanians. And as a result, the Jordanians were, besides, you know, completely, virtually closing down the Israeli embassy in Amman, not literally closing it down, but they completely broke any connections. But in addition to that, I know personally, because I heard the rabbi speak, he was in Jordan shortly after this incident.
He who, the rabbi?
This rabbi, I forgot his name right now, so don't ask me his name. He was with a group of 100 Jews, and they wouldn't allow them to pray. They wanted to put on tefillin, and the Jordanians wouldn't allow them.
Where?
I don't remember exactly, but it was some area in which the Jordanians collected them, and they were on a tour and to visit... Who's buried in Jordan?
Aaron Cohen is buried there.
Or maybe they were on the way to Aaron's Kvura, I don't remember. And I heard the man on the radio from Jordan saying that we can't pray.
I put my phone on at the airport just a month, like 2 months ago.
Say it one more time, I didn't hear.
I laced him up. I put the phone on at the airport.
The airport is something different. They don't bother you in the airport. Again, you were probably in transit, right?
Yeah, I was there 7 hours.
Oh my God.
No, but I've heard also, I think Rabbi Matra said that they went up there and they had to be very careful to not pray openly because the Jordanians didn't like it.
That's it. That's it. So there was another group, maybe at this around the same time, I don't know, where they actually would not allow, they basically had them in prison. I was so frightened because I thought they wouldn't get out of Jordan. So Jordanians let them go. But so again, you know, you'll have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi whether you should go to Jordan or not go to Jordan. But
it seems just by the words of the Psukim that initially it comes with a bit of like a negative connotation.
Absolutely.
So is that what we're trying the whole
point? Correct. The whole point of this presentation was based on a Rashi at the end of Chumash, at the end of the Torah, to say that there's another coin, another side to the coin of this whole story. This was not about big bucks. This was not about making money. The reason they wanted to settle there was L'shem Shamayim, as we'd say, for the sake of heaven. And why? Because they wanted to be close to Moshe Rabbeinu. They wanted to allow Moshe Rabbeinu to be buried there. And why was it so significant that Moshe be buried there? Because Moshe's burial place would be a kapara, would be an atonement on an annual basis for Pa'ar, which was the great sin of idol worship. And it took place, and Moshe Rabbeinu was buried by God himself in a place called Pa'ar, Mul Beit Pa'ar, because that's where we sinned, our forefathers sinned. What would allure us to sin in this most base, repulsive form of idol worship? And there's a whole philosophy here. Idol worship is more than what we think. We laugh at idol worship, don't we? Don't we tend to laugh at it? But there's more to it than meets the eye. I never studied Greek mythology, but people have told me that if you read Greek mythology, it's not just stories. They have those comic books with Greek mythology, what's his name kills, this Theus, what's
Hercules, and
Thor, was it something called Thor? Or
Thor
something?
Was Norse, he was from the...
Yeah, so this one kills that one and marries that one and all that. There's a lot more there. I know a rabbi, a very modern rabbi, who says that you're not allowed to study Greek mythology. People get PhDs in classics in Greek mythology. He's totally opposed to it. He says it's too dangerous to study Greek mythology. Now again, I'm not telling you, you'll decide for yourself, but there's more to this. Idol worship has an underlying philosophy. And here the philosophy is that God overlooks all sin. God's humility is such that he's not insulted by anything. You can't insult God. And that philosophy is so corrosive, it's so antithetical to the very foundation of Judaism. Because Judaism believes that God is very concerned with what we do and what we don't do. And Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who's going to bring this message to home. And the interesting thing is that the same attribute of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is called humility, but genuine humility, is the threefold underlying thread that connects God, Reuven, and Menashe.
The B'nai Issachar says that the reason why they're buried is because...
You know what, if I open the door just because I have another class, of course, maybe somebody came to...
He says they don't have a schus to get into Eretz Yisrael because what happened with Reuven? He came from a union where Yaakov thought he was going to be with Rachel.
Right.
He didn't know who he was with. Only afterwards, you're Leah. What are you doing here? I'm your sister. So there was a pagam there. And I think with God, I think he was the firstborn. He said of the first shivcha that maybe that Yaakov. And then and who did Yosef marry? A daughter of Dinah. No, Dinah was raped by Shechem.
I thought Shimon married. Oh, Shimon maybe married Dinah herself. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So I think Yosef married the daughter of Dinah, if I remember correctly, and Dinah was raped by.